Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 90, where Jared, Michael, Pedro, and Tom are discussing James D. Thompson's book titled Organizations in Action, Social Science Bases of Administrative Theory, originally published by McGraw-Hill in 1967. In part two, we will continue the discussion of Thompson's foundation of administrative theory and consider its contemporary implications. If you missed part one or to get the text, they are available on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. At the end of part one, we basically reached the conclusion of the book and the main point, which was to bring out what is the administrative process. That's what he was basically built the whole book around, was to present the administrative process. And we talk about co-alignment as the basic administrative function, the purpose of administration. Now, following that is the section that followed the description of co-alignment, which was what he presents as the paradox of administration. And I'll just go ahead and read this passage. If the basic function of administration involves shooting at a moving target of co-alignment, in which several components of that target are themselves moving, then we can expect the central characteristic of the administrative process to be a search for flexibility. Yet our theme throughout has been one of reduction of uncertainty and its conversion into relative certainty. How do we meet this apparent paradox? So this paradox of control or certainty against flexibility goes quite a ways back. It definitely struck a chord with me because when I'm thinking about, you know, the tradition of administration and how we use the term sometimes, and I think basically what he's getting at with the use of the term administration. Administration is inherently pushing for control and certainty at the expense of the flexibility which it should require, which it should strive for. So this has been an ever-present understanding. And I guess the question I have for everybody is, okay, what have we learned about that since then? What do we sort of take forward is, you know, if this has been a longstanding paradox, are we better at it than, or do we understand this paradox better now than we did back then?
In a way, manage by definition and etymology is about, you know, manejare, to handle. The traditional idea from Taylor and Ward words was that, you know, you need to control, measure, predict, and plan. And it's about, you know, administration is exactly about putting your hands on something and trying to prepare and predict and make things fit. And a lot of the books lead us to believe that is exactly what is happening all the time. But then he shifts around and says, well, it's happening all the time because it's a continuous process to doing that and failing to do that and trying to do it again. So when he's talking about flexibility, I understand that the kind of management he talks about is not the ability to just predict and handle, but continuously respond and adjust. So it's not to be judged by the extent to which in which what happens meets your expectations, but your ability to shift in light of the changes that are bound to happen. And I think this way he's trying to shift the idea that managing is kind of a passive attitude and more a responsive one. At least that's what I understood. And that has been, you know, maybe even too much of the way we have been thinking about administration lately, right? Which is about, you know, things are always changing. We need flexibility. We need to always, you know, stay up to things and be dynamic, right? That has become, I think, in a way, the center through which, or the lenses through which we have been understanding management for quite some time.
Maybe I want to relate to this question with maybe some examples. So I'm coordinating a master's program on organizational change, and all these students are, of course, very much interested in change and flexibility and adaptability and innovation. And one of the questions I often ask is, what is it that you want to, you know, keep? What is it that you want to have the organization not lose during change? And that question always triggers them, like, oh yeah, well, it's changing, but it's also stability, and it's the relation between these two. That's more on the organizational aspect, really, in a way more internal, maybe. But there's this case study we did with students that we visited the Central Refugee Housing Organization of the Netherlands, and their core struggle is this precise paradox, because they never know how many refugees there are and will try to get into the Netherlands. They don't know at which moment in time there a certain crisis breaks loose, or in which moment in time it will be calm, of course. So they're inflating and deflating content continuously as an organization, and yet they need to have housing available within the whole of the Netherlands. They need to have stable relations with municipalities in conducting or having these housing facilities available. They need to be able to quickly scale up in the housing possibilities for refugees, but also need to immediately decrease again in terms of housing, but also in terms of staff, for instance, for the organization, when things are more calmed down again. And this is the core struggle for them. It's a strategic question they, at every level of the organization, are struggling with. So it means something for how they train their staff. It means something for how they position the teams within the organization. It does something for establishing relations with the environment, not only municipalities, but also social work or voluntary organizations at a local level. So it's really interesting how to deal with this idea of flexibility, yet also trying to maintain a grip on something that's not in your hands.
Yeah, I like that example because I've often said that the really good change agents are also a good continuity agent. In a lot of ways, you know, when we're talking about the balance, the paradox between flexibility and certainty, it's reliability, stability, and predictability are the three terms that I've grown accustomed to using, and I didn't come up with those. Those are ones that some of my supervisors in my past military career had wanted to emphasize. And I think what's really useful about this paradox, the way that Thompson derived at it, is that we think about those terms perhaps a little bit differently. There's particular aspects of how we think about, you know, what makes them desirable. And then when we think about flexibility and change, what it is that we're trying to change. You know, for example, reliability is an expression of connections between the organization and the environment and boundary spanning and that sort of thing. The reliability is a measure of how much you are trusted with a customer or with another agency or with the environment. And in some way, you know, we think of it as a two-way street. What you're talking about there is there is no reliability, no predictability, I think, is more what you're talking about. Predictability, that is, I at least have an idea based on where I sit now, what I can see into the near-term future, that there is at least a constancy of demand. And there, when there is no predictability, what that does to the organization is extraordinary. And what I saw in the, I'm not sure which chapter it is, I think it's chapter 9, discretion and its exercise. There were a couple of propositions here that came to mind. Here we go. When workloads or resource supplies fluctuate, the individual is tempted to stockpile. Okay, proposition 9.6. So what do? Do you keep a cold contract open for facilities just in case 100,000 people show up at your door on a particular day, that sort of thing? Where I said before in part one that, you know, we got to be careful about using these propositions because they are proposals for research, but that doesn't mean that they're not necessarily insightful and can, you know, because they were derived from actual case studies, they do tend to make sense. And they can help us describe and explain what the heck we're doing in cases where control and flexibility are at loggerheads, or certainty and flexibility are at loggerheads. What are some of the behaviors that we could expect on the basis of that?
The stockpiling, it's interesting that you mentioned it, because when I was reading it, there was one example coming to mind. It was the mouth masks, the COVID masks. Everyone was stockpiling masks and trying to, I mean, nothing was predictable anymore. We couldn't rely on anything anymore. So the only thing we knew was like, oh yeah, we need IC beds, we need mouth masks, and all governments were trying to really get at those facilities in hand. So that was, in hindsight, kind of an interesting read from the book. Like, oh yeah, the stockpiling, the predictability, and what happens when the environment really is in flux, and what is a way of because that's what he tries to describe in that chapter. What are ways of trying to deal with this insecurities and flux within the broader environment, and stockpiling is one of the strategies, right? So yeah.
So besides what Tom was just saying, because I think one of the wisdoms that comes from the book is that dealing with this paradox, you know, and trying to achieve certainty in a world of flux is about being clearly what is the task. And the example that Michael gave showed this clearly, right? Because it started by saying they are trying to provide housing for refugees, but A, B, C, D, F, right? So one of the insights that comes from the book is understanding exactly flexibility in purpose of something, like you just said, Tom. But the other thing I think it comes from the book and general what we know about organizational analysis is that flexibility varies and relates differently to different parts of the organizations, right? So that is a key idea. And I think it talks something along those lines that depending of what kind of department and what kind of position and how the organization was structured and what kind of uncertainty is emerging from the environment and related to what aspects of the operations, then you're going to deal that differently. And in some things will be more dynamic than others. And some of them will have to change a particular moment. And some of them will have to have maybe more redundancy than others, right? So I think that some of the wisdoms to relate to what you're saying, that is, you know, all good change is also about keeping things, but it's also trying to understand that there are different kind of demands, pressures, and issues, and they relate different to different parts and aspects of the organization as well, on how they can respond to them.
Yeah, building on this, I think something that I've found an interesting insight from the book is, well how Thompson talks about the managerial level. And so he sets up at the beginning that proposition 2.1, under norms of rationality, organizations seek to seal off their core technologies from environmental influences. But then if you're balancing that on the one hand with the notion that there are open systems, there are changes in the external environment, there are crises that increase the number of refugees that you're having to deal with as an organization, the managerial level kind of mediates between those external, I guess, changes, contextual changes, as well as that kind of closed off, what does he call it, the production or technology, technical level stuff. And I think, you know, your example, Michael, is really great for illustrating. I imagine the managers within this particular organization are doing that, or are continually playing that mediating role between the provision of housing and, you know, what's going on in the external environment. And that was a really insightful way of bringing together these seemingly kind of binary concepts of rational and open systems.
Yeah, and indeed. I mean, it is the location managers which are kind of essential, right? So they're the mid-level, you might say, of the organization steering these housing locations. And that's where the aspect that we discussed in the last section of the previous episode is like the administrative process is at all levels, right? So it's not something that happens within the strategic apex of the organization, but it happens on the ground floor. It is situated with the managers of these locations and trying to get a grip on the influx of refugees, having these relationships with stakeholders in the direct environment. So what you see also is that these location managers in times of crises are able to manage a range of locations, right? Rather than just one. While in normal situations, they're focused on kind of one setting. So that's a way of dealing with this unpredictability having the what's the word again? Sorry, I'm lost it.
Well, we had predictability, reliability, and stability. Was it one of those three?
No, it was the chain of command. But if you manage like seven people, what's again? Span of control. Yeah. So, you know, just the span of control in terms of locations is broadened up in a way of dealing with this unpredictability and influx for the organization.
Yeah, and I think it's also a good one, you know, because on the one hand, there's unpredictability when something is going to happen. Even in, for a crisis response organization, there's sort of a difference between how predictable something can be versus, say, how intractable something can be. The example I like to use here is for natural disasters, which, you know, there's some parallels because there are certain natural disasters. Like if you live in a certain part of the world, you know that certain natural disasters, as horrific as they're going to be, are at least in some way predictable. They may be predictable in time because they're seasonal, or at least in some respect, there's, like with earthquakes, if you're living in a place where you have earthquakes, then you at least know that you've got to be prepared for the potentiality of an earthquake could happen at any time. And so then there's a predictability associated with that. But then there are other natural, other disasters where it's completely intractable, where the qualitative nature of the crisis is potentially unknowable because it might be a serious one-off of some kind. Well, like a snow in a place that almost never gets snow. In the United States, if you live up north, you can expect snow. But if you're down in the south, then you do not expect to get snow. So even if you get a small bit of snow, it becomes a significant event because there is no capability there to handle it. Why I bring this example up is that you're restricting the domain for a particular set of crises so that you can align up capabilities or the ability to expand capabilities to sort of meet it. Whereas in other circumstances, and I think some of what Thompson was getting at in the complexity and the discretion, what do you do in the case when a crisis or something happens that is intractable, that is totally beyond what the organization is organized to do? How does the organization respond? How does it prepare? That's a whole different challenge to flexibility.
Yeah, and this goes to the heart of one of, I guess, Thompson's contributions is that the heart of administrative processes is dealing with uncertainty, which is going to arise. And so it's how can organizations or these entities organize to deal with that uncertainty when it does come up?
So I wanted to spin the conversation a bit. So we covered about the part of administration, right, and this challenge, and there was great to think about this case study. But there's another crucial aspect of the book, and one that has a huge impact, which is exactly the development of this open system thinking, right? And we, you know, named some of them in part one, population ecology, institutional theory, right? And if it was quite interesting to see the way he's talking about the environment, because to a large extent, it's about, you know, the kind of resources, the inputs and outputs. But he also talked about some stuff that I found a bit more surprising, right? The role of culture, for example, or the extent in which the environmental kind of provide resources that are not just, you know, raw materials or political power, but also the kind of ideas and values and the orientation that people have towards their career, right? Which are very much connected with, you know, he calls the social system, but you can say society. And he also makes some interesting comparisons in this idea that there are particular, you know, his assumptions that in industrialized countries or settings, you'd expect that some values would be present or some orientations to the job or some kind of, you know, skills, whatever, be present, and contrast that with ones that, you know, we would call today maybe developing nations or global south or whatever. And this is kind of very hidden and kind of, you know, almost like on the side, but it's quite interesting. And it's something that today I would say that's very central to discussions, right? From, you know, social development, economic development, or how we think about the limits of organizational theory or theory that was produced in particular places, how it applies to other places. So I was kind of surprised to see this attention to the specificity of the context, not just in terms of what kind of things exist in the environment, but what kind of environment it is and how it relates to the way organizations function and how it provides some resources and ideas that may align or misalign with ways of organizing, right? I thought it was kind of very contemporary almost in the sensitivity and the kind of topic he was trying to put forward.
Yeah, I agree, Pedro. I mean, he's very prescient, I think, in the perspective that he brings to what organizations are and how they organize. But in some ways, we shouldn't be so surprised because the full title of the book is Organizations in Action, Social Science Bases of Administrative Theory. We've spoken quite a bit about how much this book covers in a shorter number of pages, but really underpinning all of what he's written here is a social science perspective and what it can illuminate about the administrative process. And I think, yeah, you touched on there a few things around culture and fundamental aspects of people and things like this. So it's, again, another reason why it's such a kind of classic of classics, I think.
Yeah, it calls, you know, the institutional environmental setting of organization a wider social system that is a source of meaning for what happens within the organization. So that's just echoing what Pedro was saying, of course. But this idea of the environment as a source of meaning, that meaning itself is a resource for organizations and what their actual range of possibilities actually is. That's intriguing for the book. I would agree, and for a book that's from 55 years old. So maybe that's also something that we kind of could focus on further. Is there the idea of the paradox of administration that we previously discussed? How is that related in a way maybe to this idea of, you know, this institutional perspective on a source of meaning? How is it that he kind of is able to view administration as a paradox at that moment in time?
Now, that's a very, very good question. One of the things I was thinking about was about the environment imposing itself upon the organization. I was also thinking about the reverse. The way that he talks about organizations imposing themselves on the environment. This kind of comes to the fore when he talks about social aspects of administration, really towards the end of that chapter. Here's a one example passage, which I think is, there's a lot of truth to this. Once an organization has become established and has demonstrated capacities, the social costs of dismantling it are large and dismantling is seldom permitted. I mean, it's basically the institutionalization of an organization. If one has, if a particular organization has come to fulfill a role in society that society has become dependent upon, and in fact, it's become a formal or informal part of the society, it becomes really, really difficult when the organization starts to fail or starts to have difficulties. You can see how societies would jump in and try to preserve it and keep it going, which is itself an example of the paradox of administration, because in a true sense, you know, we would think that, well, if an organization is failing, we should replace it with something else, right? But as he highlights, that sort of change can be very, very disruptive to more than just simply the organization itself. And so we end up with all these durable structures. I'm using W. Richard Scott's terms. These durable structures that try to, in a way, try to keep something afloat that perhaps shouldn't be. I imagine we can probably come up with plenty of examples of that.
But failing to whom and under what assumptions? And I think that is something that he discusses, again, in a tacit, indirect way. And when he says that sometimes some behavior that would be understood as irrational, but would make, you know, if you look at the context in which the organization is operating, is actually rational, given any kind of constraint that it has or resources that are not present or in kind of, you know, the history or the culture in which it's operating. So I think the other thing I found that was kind of, that struck me was this openness, despite all this talk about rationality, to almost to look at there is kind of, you know, the cultural basis of rationality and organizing, that what can appear as odd or not fulfilling a purpose can in itself, if you think in contextual terms, act to serve a purpose and, you know, be even rational given the conditions in which organizations operate.
How about one other passage I'd like to highlight, because this is another one that, kind of going back to the individual. This is under the current challenge to administration. The administrative process works brilliantly in some of our most significant organizations, as well as in some of the less significant ones. But there is no guarantee that the society which assigns up importance to complex organizations will be able to provide them with administrators equal to the task. I starred that particular phrase because this kind of gets into, you know, all of this talk about complexity. Well, we hadn't actually gotten into very much. And I think, you know, he's sort of intimating this, but what we hadn't really gotten into much is the individual capacity to handle what is this whole task of administration. It's sort of written into my mind things like the what we call the Peter Principle. Somebody gets promoted to beyond their capacity. I'm making light of this, but it is interesting to me that you know, when we think about power and the coalitions and all of these sorts of things, of ways that organizations cope with complexity. But the ultimate bottom line that he's sort of serving up is that there's a limit to what humans can do. We make these organizations complex, and the environments around them continue to become more and more complex. Does this mean that we may reach a point, or are we reaching a point, where we actually can't control the organizations that we create?
I mean, many people would say yes. You know, we haven't talked as much about the work of people like Charles Perrow, but that's when, you know, the whole idea, the system becomes so complex that we can expect normal accidents and so on. But I wanted to say something else, because I think that within this discussion, again, maybe I just like to read between the lines, but I feel that Thompson is talking about also the emotional complexity, not just the cognitive complexity a la March and Simon, right? But indirectly also talking about, and he talks about this most clearly when he talks about discretion and the way people may struggle to exercise discretion or may not want to exercise discretion and may use different systems to avoid, you know, discretion from rules and protocols and procedures and whatever. Right, which made me think about our recent episode about anxiety in organizations by Isabel Menzies-Leith, right, episode 88, in which we have learned the way in which people that are facing a particularly emotionally challenging task, like nurses in a teaching hospital, right, may develop a series of mechanisms that are, to some extent, not really resolving, but just a way to cope with the stress and, in this case, the anxiety of the job, right, which is a lot about diffusing this responsibility or trying to abide by protocols and, you know, and it seems to be something about here on the extent in which, because of the complexity, because of the uncertainty, because of the need for flexibility, discretion is expected, but it can be very hard to stomach, quite, you know, to put it like, you know, in direct words. And then we create further systems to deal with that and resolve that and try to evade that, so to speak. Right. So it just showcases the, I don't want to say like layers of complexity, but how in understanding the organizations there are kind of, you know, layered aspects that are in place and limits that are not just cognitive, but emotional as well in the work that people do.
Proposition 9.1a, organizations can thwart the exercise of discretion by establishing inappropriate structures. The Menzies-Leith episode restated.
It seems like Menzies-Leith was a reader of the book.
Perhaps. Which came first? I should know, but I don't. It's not coming to mind.
So the Tavistock and Menzies-Leith is so that
I want to say it was 1952, wasn't it?
So the paper on Menzies-Leith is 1960.
Oh, there we go. That's it just kind of shows in a lot of ways how the classics, even if they don't necessarily inform each other, how a lot of them find their own ways to similar ideas, just expressed differently. I've cherry-picked a couple of propositions in this episode from Chapter 9, but I think that if we were to actually go through all of them, we would find a lot of things that are parallel with other episodes that we've done from studies of the same period of how individuals and organizations interact or fail to interact with respect to deviations or, you know, stresses and that sort of thing. So that's another very, very interesting aspect of the book, of how it bridged individuals and organizations in ways that perhaps were not as common at the time.
Should we wrap up?
Just a thought. I mean, would it be worth mentioning how this work laid? I know we've kind of touched on it a little bit in different ways, but how it shaped the emergence of particular areas of inquiry, you know, maybe things like contingency theory. I don't know if, Pedro, you would want to speak to that. I know Thompson was touched on in your PDW episode some time back, so it might be worth making that cross-reference as well.
Yeah. Okay, so I can do that, and I can talk about contingency when I do the wrap-up.
Maybe I can give a try for wrapping up my part. Then. So we've been talking about this book, and especially in this episode, on the paradox of administration. And to me, I would say there are two elements that kind of also come to mind, and maybe not something to explore further, but he is in several ways describing processes within organizations and using or mentioning kind of the element of time in dealing or for organizations to deal with their struggles in relation to their environment, as well as this element of paradox. And these are two quite strong connected developments within organization theory. So the paradox approach and the process studies approach. What I find interesting in these classics again and again is how you discover really small bits and pieces that are used in a much broader scope nowadays in organization theory. And I wouldn't say Thompson is classic for those two approaches, for instance, but it already provides some insights, some elements that are taken up by current scholars and in current debates on the centrality of process, or the aspect of paradoxes and how to deal with paradoxes in organizing. So I think that's interesting. And to me, I would like to kind of finish with his final sentence of the book, at least the last part of that sentence. To study organizations in toto and, for that purpose, the significance of the open system approach and the certainty-uncertainty dimension, this is what he ends up with the book. And that's interesting. I would say that he comes back to the dimension of certainty, uncertainty. This dimension is previously discussed as a paradox, but here he presents it as a dimension as well. And I would say it's a central dimension to the open system approach that a lot of books and articles that followed from this book by Thompson dived into.
So I have a reflection that follows from that, because that was also something that struck me. I have read bits and pieces of the book before during the PhD, but never read, you know, in detail, cover to cover. And I also realize it is much richer than what we cited for, as always happens, right? And there is something certainly about this processual understanding that is much more dynamic, I would have expected. But even thinking in terms of the more, you know, older lines of inquiry that has started, like contingency that we discussed in the PDW that we had at AOM in episode 58, that there is something about strategy that is trying to talk about. There's something about the environment as not just this undifferentiated universe, right? But this attempt to not just to fit, but trying to fit, how this is a continuous effort of organizations to find their way through their environment and how the environment is changing and their organization is changing in relationships. So it's less this debate about the match, about a particular type of markets or particular type of products and so on, but it's the matching that seems that Thompson's trying to get at and try to theorize on how we may expect some kind of strategies or approaches or, you know, tactics to emerge given some conditions, and how this, there's a continuous effort to make that work and this link to connect. Similarly, you know, there is a lot about the open systems that has informed institutional theory. But what I found interesting here is that it's very much something that I think that got a little bit lost in our theorizing, which is the social basis of organizing and this idea of the meaning as a resource and the ways in which these aspirations from the individual all the way to the type of skills that may exist may be connected to the organization. So not just this kind of, again, undifferentiated kind of cognitive ideas that exist at large, but more specifically, right, the ideas that people bring on how to organize, of people, the expectations they bring towards their job, what they take for granted in terms of how the organization should function and what is their role within that, and in what extent this get worked out and shaped and reshaped and incorporated in the way organizations function, right? So I think it was interesting to see that even in lines of inquiry that have taken up and listened to many of the insights here, there was still a lot that can be mined and explored, and in particular, showing how this process is a processual one, dynamic that takes effort, and bringing us always and bringing an attention to the role of the task for which all this is taking place, which I think has been a little bit lost in some of these broader discussions about open systems in their more recent forms.
And I'll go ahead and follow because, you know, of course, I read these classic texts with a practitioner's lens. And so one of the things that I find refreshing in going back to the classics is sometimes because they're at the formative stages of this sort of thinking, they can express things in ways that are simpler, that are a little bit more, you know, you can see from where current literature is stemming from. And sometimes the current literature in its quest for, you know, greater accuracy, greater understanding through empirical study, whatever, sometimes can isn't quite as clear as, say, the classic texts are. And there's a lot of things that I drew from the way that Thompson put forth his propositions that were aha moments that now I'm rethinking perhaps what more recent literature was presenting, especially when it comes to some of the things that we talked about in understanding the roots of complexity, understanding discretion, understanding the roots of the inner circle and the complexity of how the organizations interact with the environment. Because even this morning, as I'm teaching a class, some of these topics came up and it's like I could draw from Thompson and bring some of this in right away a little bit more simply than perhaps some more recent literature.
Yeah, so some closing thoughts for me. I mean, I've, like many of you there, have been struck by the processual underpinnings of what's written here. And I've noticed myself during our discussion, and I think you guys have done it also a little bit, kind of using the term organizing in ways which Thompson doesn't, you know, use it. And I've kind of been struck by how the way we speak about some aspects of organizations has evolved over time. And we don't talk so much about administration. I definitely don't. And I think perhaps the way the reason we've moved away from that particular term is it has a more kind of directive tone, perhaps. And so we've now, as our understandings have evolved, we've moved more towards framing things about processes of organizing, and because that allows for ongoing evolution and reorganizing and so on. So, but it has been very interesting to see how that in such an early text in the evolution of the field started to come through, that processual aspect of organizing organizations in action.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.